This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Alec Murdaugh. You've been watching the Murdaugh Hulu series? It's good. I've been finding it very fascinating. We're going to dive into some interesting news in the case, the idea, the very real possibility that Alec Murdaugh could be getting a new murder trial. It's not hype. It's not spin. It's actually, if you're playing along at home and have been for any time and watching what went down after that trial, what they found out about the clerk of court, what was said, what was done, the misconduct, even if you think he's guilty of sin and he's a horrible, horrible human being, I don't think that there's a whole lot of anyone that's saying he's not. If you believe in the rule of law, you may need to believe that he deserves a second murder trial. Believe me, kind of pains me to say that, but if we're playing along with how, you know, we want fairness, we want accuracy, we want justice. Some horrible crimes over here don't always mean a horrible crime over here. I don't know the answer to exactly what happened here. But when you have a clerk of court trying to influence a jury and they have an actual jury member saying, she influenced me, well, that's not a fair trial anymore now, is it? No matter who is on trial. Take Alec Murdaugh out of it for a second. So we're gonna dive into this, and I want to get your thoughts in the comment section. So please hit subscribe, and please do in the comment section give me your thoughts. Hot tea today. All right, we got three filings, two stories, one truth. The state of South Carolina is trying to decide which one of all of this that it can live with, or what combination it can live with. Alec Murdaugh sits in prison, serving two life sentences for murdering his wife Maggie and his son Paul. But in a sense, he's not the one really on trial anymore. What's actually on trial now is the process that put him there. So, got to keep that in mind as we talk about this. This is not about the act itself. This is about the process that put him there, the trial, the people, the system, and the promise that justice can survive the weight of its own ambition. The South Carolina Supreme Court now holds three documents that could reshape everything. One from the Attorney General's office, the state's closing argument, and the verdict was fair. That's what they're saying. The evidence overwhelming and the outcome inevitable. Two from Murdaugh's legal team, one final brief and one final reply, both arguing that his trial was fatally compromised by jury tampering, improper evidence, and investigative misconduct so severe it shredded the idea of a fair proceeding. Two very diametrically opposed opinions, right? The question in front of the justice isn't whether Alec Murdaugh is guilty or innocent. It's whether his conviction can stand when the scaffolding beneath it is cracked. To get there, you have to remember how much chaos came before. The trial itself felt more like a cultural event than a criminal proceeding. A Southern Gothic courtroom drama watched by millions. It had everything. Bloodlines, betrayal, and the slow collapse of a dynasty that once ruled the Lowcountry's courts. But as the cameras left and the dust settled, the story kept mutating. What began as a murder case became a referendum on corruption, not just Murdaugh's, but the state's. Murdaugh's attorney, Dick Harpootalian, and Jim Griffin, Philip Barber, and Maggie Fox filed their final brief with one thesis. This is new. That this conviction was poisoned from the inside. They say the Colleton County Clerk of Court, Rebecca Becky Hill, didn't just supervise the jury, she steered it. In sworn statements, at least one juror said Hill told them to watch Alec's body language and don't be fooled. And that may be true, but you can't say that to a jury. That's not an observation, it's coaching. And under constitutional law, That's not just wrong, it's fatal. It's illegal. When a court official communicates with jurors during trial, the law presumes prejudice. When you're doing any sort of communication beyond, what's your lunch order? Hill has since faced her own legal troubles, arrested for unrelated misconduct. Her credibility, already bruised, now sits at the center of one of the most consequential appeals in the state's history. The defense paints her as an opportunist, a local clerk chasing a book deal who turned a murder trial into her personal moment of fame. The state calls her remarks foolish and fleeting, claiming they reached only a handful of jurors and changed nothing. You can claim anything you want to feel. It changed nothing. Why do you have an actual juror saying, no, it did influence me? I think that kind of contradicts your statement of it changed nothing. You're not the juror. They are. The juror saying, yes, it did. But that single juror affidavit cuts through all the legal language. She told us to watch him, and I did. That's influence. It's not theoretical. That's a human mind being nudged inside a jury room where no one else is allowed to speak. And it wasn't the only claim of contamination. The defense argues the trial itself became something else entirely, not about evidence, but about character destruction. They call it a trial within a trial. For a full week, prosecutors walked jurors through Alec Murdaugh's history of financial crimes, lies, and theft. None of it proved murder. All of it made him look monstrous. The defense says that testimony drowned out the lack of direct forensic proof tying him to the killings. The prosecution insists those details were critical, that they explain motive, that by the time of the murders, Murdaugh's world was collapsing under the weight of stolen money and impending exposure. He wasn't killing for money, they said. He was killing to buy time. They call it the gathering storm theory. That the murders paused the fallout just long enough for him to breathe. The defense calls that fantasy, the suggestion that someone would commit double murder to delay a routine legal proceeding defies logic and human experience, they wrote. The third prong of the defense argument dives into forensics, not flashy, but damning, if true. They accuse South Carolina's law enforcement division, SLED, of mishandling the evidence. No fingerprint lifts in the feed room doors, DNA from under Maggie's fingernails, never run through CODIS, a blood splatter expert allegedly pressured to alter findings after his original report didn't match the prosecution's theory. And when lab results showed no human blood on Murdaugh's shirt, the defense says the state quietly dropped their evidence rather than admit it had been wrong. Taken together, they argue it's not one mistake, it's a mosaic of failures. The case was fundamentally compromised from the beginning, their brief reads, built on investigative incompetence, prosecutorial misconduct, and court official corruption. Then came the state's response. 182 pages of counterpunch. Attorney General Alan Wilson's office called the appeal nothing more than an attempt to relitigate what the jury already decided. They doubled down on the strength of the evidence, the dog kennel video, placing Murdaugh at the scene minutes before the murders, his repeated lies to law enforcement, and digital evidence showing both victims' phones locked within 30 seconds of each other. The Attorney General's office described the verdict as solely the product of the jury's honest deliberation, citing retired Chief Justice Gene Toll's order denying Murdaugh a new trial. But if you followed anything with the Gene Toll hearings, Gene didn't want anything to do with it. She was punting it down the road. In their view, the misconduct claims were exaggerated, the forensic complaints irrelevant, and the financial testimony fair game. Even if the court erred, they wrote, any error was harmless given the avalanche of proof. But the defense's final reply brief, filed the next day, hits back like a closing argument to the nation. They open with a jab at the state's sheer volume. The state's brief is 60,000 words long, nearly a dissertation. Yet, on the most important issue, it fails in its very first sentence. That first sentence, they remind the court, says Becky Hill's comments did not affect the outcome. The defense calls it a speculative answer to the wrong question. The Constitution doesn't ask whether the verdict was correct. It asks whether the trial was fair. They dismantle the harmless error narrative line by line, insisting there is no overwhelming evidence. Exception to due process. They accuse the state of mistreating facts, misrepresenting evidence, and defending a verdict built on a structurally defective trial that they drive home their thesis again. The state's case was not overwhelming. It was built on investigative failures, fabricated evidence, and jury tampering. For the state, it's a procedural defense. They argue Murdaugh waived some of his objections at trial, that the financial testimony was largely admissible under multiple theories, and that Becky Hill's words were unfortunate but meaningless. For the defense, it's a moral defense of the system itself, that if misconduct by an official inside the courthouse can be brushed off because the evidence looks strong, then the rule of law itself starts to rot. And that's where the entire debate now lives, in this gray space between law and legitimacy. South Carolina's highest court isn't just reviewing a murder conviction. It's deciding how much imperfection it can tolerate in exchange for finality. If the court rules the verdict stands, it tells the world that justice, even when messy, held firm. If it grants a new trial, if it tells the world that corruption from within, even subtle, can't be excused just because a guilty man was caught, either way, it's not just Murdaugh's fate hanging in the balance, it's the credibility of the very machinery that convicted him. The juror affidavit makes that real. You can talk about evidence all day, but nothing erodes faith like a whisper from inside the system. One juror, one comment, one shift in perception, and suddenly you're staring at the possibility that a trial watched by millions could have been steered by a courthouse employee trying to sell a memoir. That's the crack in the facade. And that's what makes the appeal so dangerous for the state, because once you admit the process can be touched, you can't pretend the verdict is untouchable. For now, the South Carolina Supreme Court has a choice. They can call for oral arguments or decide on the filings alone. If they affirm the verdict, Murdaugh's only options will be a post-conviction relief petition for a federal habeas challenge. Both are very long shots, but not impossible. The Fourth Circuit has already overturned one Murdaugh-related conviction before, proving even powerful systems can stumble twice. So here we are again at the intersection of justice and spectacle. The family name that once built courthouses now lingers as a ghost inside them. The lawyers keep writing, the public keeps arguing, and the system keeps trying to convince itself that this is what accountability looks like. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But the truth that keeps echoing through all of this is painfully simple. You can despise Alec Murdaugh and still demand that his trial be clean. You can think he's guilty and still wonder if the state cut corners to make sure the story ended neatly. Fairness isn't something you give because someone deserves it. It's something you protect because everyone else might need it someday. That's the paradox of this case. The state says the evidence was overwhelming. The defense says the misconduct was overwhelming. And the rest of us are left wondering which version of overwhelming the South Carolina Supreme Court will choose to believe. Because at this point, the fight isn't about who pulled the trigger. It's about whether the system itself still fires straight. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. I'd love to hear them. Do you think he deserves a new trial based on what happened in that courthouse? Not on the evidence of the case, based on the arguments of what happened in that courthouse. Also, the investigation. Gotta say, tons of people trampling around that place right away. Certain tasks not being done that should have been done. It wasn't good. You can blame the police for that. You can blame SLED for that. You don't do your job right the first time. You don't usually get a second chance in a case like this, because once the evidence is tampered with, destroyed, corrupted, contaminated, it's done. There's no do-overs. There's no, oh, oops. What do you think? Are the arguments strong enough? Would it be interesting to see another Murdaugh trial? Yeah, it sure as hell would. Do I think he should get it if we didn't have the Becky Hill issues? Probably not. But we do, and they're there, and this is where we live. Your thoughts. Search Hitting Killers with Tony Bruschi on YouTube. If that's not where you're at right now, if you're listening to us, do that search and join us over there, please. You can comment on everything and join our conversations on our cases and our videos. And hit subscribe as well, wherever you're listening to us. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.